Welcome to our third and final day for this week of oral argument. This morning, Judge Hall and Judge Abudu and I are hearing four cases, and then this afternoon we'll hear two more. So we'll get started with our first four today, and I thank counsel for being flexible on scheduling. We really appreciate that. I think you are probably familiar with our system, but green light means go, yellow light means get ready to stop, and red light means stop. If the court is asking you questions, then we'll certainly let you finish your answer. So with that, we've got our first case, which is Equate 2 LLC versus Myers. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Scott Williams. I'm here on with my colleague on behalf of my client, Equate 2. Equate 2 is part of a family of companies that is owned by the Alabama Cosarte tribe that participate in the 8A small business program that allows for competitive bidding on government contracting. The appellees in this case are Gitawa, a global government group, which is an entity owned and controlled by the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, and Ms. Myers. Ms. Myers formerly was an employee of Equate and then went to work at Gitawa. And I will apologize in advance. I think it's Gitawa. We've worked through the Indian pronunciations.
We won't know any different anyway.
I'll stand corrected by my opposing counsel. Your Honor, this case turns on because both Equate and Gitawa chose to go into a competitive bid for a program called the SBX-1, which is part of the United States' nuclear defense program, and it is a contract that provided security for vessels in the Pacific. Equate 2 had that contract. When Ms. Myers worked for Equate 2, the contract was expiring and was up for competitive bid again. Both Equate 2 was partnering and Gitawa was partnering with others to, again, try and win that contract. I'll wrap up kind of the factual part of this with the interesting part of this whole discussion is that neither of us won that government contract, which put a damper on everybody's sights. There are two key issues I want to go through today, and I think I'll start with the sovereign immunity issue. I think that's what is landmark as far as this case, this court is concerned, and the reason we requested oral argument. That is subject to de novo review. And in that, it is the issue of what does related to under the SBA programs mean as it relates to Native American tribes and groups waiving their sovereign immunity? Typically, Native American tribes and their entities will have sovereign immunity, and you cannot sue them for their acts as a sovereign nation and instrumentalities of that nation. However, to participate in the 8A program, the SBA requires, the federal regs require, and let me see if I can see you exactly. Gitawa, in its organization document, says they waived for all disputes and other matters relating to involvement in programs of the Small Business Administration, including but not limited to 8A Business Development Program, participation, loans, and contract performance. That related to is the key issue.
The district court said that Equate's claims are not based on Kittawa's participation in the 8A program and do not involve allegations that Kittawa violated any of the 8A program's requirements. Rather, its claims derive from defendants' alleged misappropriation of trade secrets to bid on a contract that, incidentally, is only open to 8A participants. So why is the district court wrong about that?
The district court is completely wrong, Your Honor, for this reason. In order to participate in the 8A program, you have to competitively bid. And part of the competitively bid process is gathering lots of information. Those bids will take days, sometimes weeks, to prepare, and you gather a bunch of information to competitively bid against one another. Let me give you an example why it's particularly relevant. The 8A program and the waiver of sovereign immunity really is designed to create an even playing field amongst all the participants of the 8A program. Those may include black minority-owned companies, Hispanic, women-owned companies, disabled veteran companies. They all compete on a level playing field. If, for example, one of you owned an 8A entity that was able to compete for a government contract, if one of your employees equates government secrets, I could sue your company for misappropriation of those trade secrets. In this case, GIDWA is trying to assert its sovereign immunity, which goes completely against this idea of creating a level playing field amongst all the participants of the 8A program. I hope I answered the court's question.
I actually have a question about the other issue.
Sure.
So why, you assert that this tribal court does not exist, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
So why would you include in a contract a tribal court that did not exist?
We explicitly provide in our employee handbook, and that employee handbook can be found in the supplemental documents that are under sealed in Exhibit 31A provided by the appellees. If you look at the handbook, it says that can be done in tribal court if it exists. That is specifically written into that handbook.
But it's not in the contract.
It is not in the contract, Your Honor. But the contract also says we will abide by what is in the handbook. And the handbook explicitly recognizes that there may be situations where that tribal court may not exist. In the Native American scheme, there are also regional courts that sometimes will be able to provide jurisdiction for Native American tribes. There is not one for North Alabama.
So is that the CFR court?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so there's not one of those either?
There is not one of those either. That would have been an alternative forum. Importantly, to get to the heart of your question, because that is a manifest error question, and clear error for the court in order to be able to reverse, it is clear error that Judge Kahlon made when he determined that a court existed, because a court could not exist. Our Constitution, the tribal constitution for the Alabama Cosarte tribe, does not provide for it. The Comstock opinion is on all fours in this particular issue. Both the district court and the circuit court recognized that cites the United States Supreme Court opinion in National Farmers Union versus the Crow Tribe. In that opinion, for the proposition that district courts can make a determination whether or not a tribal court exists, and that is Comstock. That's a relevant Fifth Circuit case. I will acknowledge that the issue related in the supplemental case that was provided after briefing was initially done, that involved the Alabama Cosarte tribe, Old Town, versus First National Bank, that I'm sure you all have reviewed, that is a case where that district court found that there was an intertribal dispute. That's good law. That is good law. If there's an intertribal dispute, district courts should not get involved in those. We accept that proposition. However, the very fact that a tribal court can or cannot exist is fundamental. Importantly, as part of all of that, what Judge Kahlon relied on, in addition to simply not recognizing the Constitution doesn't provide for it, is that there was no evidence before Judge Kahlon.
I'm looking at the agreement, and I don't see a reference saying you should look to the employee handbook. Are you sure that's in this dispute resolution policy?
Your Honor.
You just represented the court that if I look at this, which says we all know what it says, that I'd see it refers you to the handbook. I believe that's what you said.
Your Honor.
Isn't that what you said?
I don't exactly recall what I said.
Okay. Do you maintain now that this dispute, you said we shouldn't just go on the four terms of this because it refers to a handbook or a manual, and we should then look at that as to what they talk about if it exists.
Your Honor, there's a series of documents that all employees of Equate and the family of companies sign.
But shouldn't we just construe this policy? We should just look at the four corners of this document. Why do we look at anything else? Help me with that.
Sure, Your Honor, I'll be happy to. I think an example is the best way to describe this. I can contractually enter into a contract with you that says, if we have a dispute, that will be heard by the Federal District Court for the Northern District of Alabama. You and I enter into a contract that says that.
We're not talking about just any contract. This is an employment agreement. It's very common. Everybody now agrees where you're going to litigate or resolve your dispute. So this is just common. And why should we not enforce this contract, other than what I hear you say, is that court doesn't exist?
Correct, Your Honor.
What other than that, why we shouldn't have enforced the four corners of this contract?
The reason is because it's a jurisdictional issue. And in my example, I started down that path. For example, in the contract that you and I might have, we might say that the Federal District Court has jurisdiction. But if the court doesn't have jurisdiction, it can't hear that case. In this case, there is no court, although there may have been a...
Okay, I ask, other than the court doesn't exist, is there any other reason other than that why we shouldn't enforce this contract, policy, employment agreement?
Your Honor, I think that is the crux of it, because that, if you look at the standard for review as it relates to this issue, it is... clear error. And we believe it is clear error for the court, the district court, not to have recognized that there was not a court and there could not be a court.
Whose burden is it to show that there is or is not a court? Where does that burden fall between the parties?
The burden falls in the part seeking the dismissal of the case. And in this case, in the forum nonconvenience analysis in the Saltz case that this circuit has ruled on, is that if a party wishes to dismiss for forum nonconvenience, it's your burden to show that an alternative court is allowed to...
You can tell me why I'm wrong about this. The law is that if a contract specifies a place and you want to challenge that place, okay, you then go to an analysis. It's not just strictly FN... forum nonconvenience, you go to forum selection, and you have to show the forum selection, that's a subpart of forum nonconvenience, you have to show the selected venue, you have the burden to show the selected venue is not extant, let's say, for lack of jurisdiction, to use your term. Why is that not correct? You have the burden because of it was a selected venue.
I understand. The initial question is related to forum nonconvenience. Your analysis is correct as it relates to the burden shifting. We believe we met that burden when...
So you have the burden to show the tribal court does not exist.
Correct, Your
Honor. Okay.
Although, I had a question about that. In Atlantic Marine, the court says in footnote 5 on page 62, our analysis presupposes a contractually valid forum selection clause. So what does that do to the analysis? You think it doesn't change it?
I don't think it changes the analysis at all, Your Honor, for this reason. Jurisdiction is fundamental. It has to be there in order for the parties to have an adequate forum to resolve their disputes. If there is no jurisdiction, that dispute cannot be resolved there. It's fundamental. This court has repeatedly said that jurisdiction is fundamental to the parties being able to resolve the dispute. And in this case, since there was no court, there can't be a forum to resolve that dispute.
Can a forum that does not exist be part of a contractually valid forum clause, forum election clause?
Your Honor, another example, if I refer back to the example I used previously, parties can contract anything. Whether or not that confers jurisdiction or not is a wholly separate.
No, I mean, I agree there are multiple layers, but I'm curious whether you think that in order for a forum selection clause to be contractually valid in the first place, the forum that is selected has to exist.
I don't think it can be contractually valid if the forum doesn't exist, I think is the answer, is what your court the okay. court's asking.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kappelman.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Ben Kappelman for defendants' appellees. Beginning where my friend left off, we agree that the sole issue on appeal is whether the tribal court is an adequate alternative forum such that the forum selection clause should be enforced. That's the only issue or challenge that's been raised on appeal with regard to the forum selection clause. And as to whose burden it is, I wholeheartedly agree that it is appellant as the entity seeking to avoid the effect of the forum selection clause that it wrote that bears the burden of showing that that forum is not adequate.
Why isn't it your burden as the party seeking to dismiss the lawsuit?
Well, Your Honor, I think Atlantic Marine speaks directly to that. Quoting from that case, as the party defying the forum selection clause, the plaintiff bears the burden of establishing that transfer to the forum for which the parties bargained is unwarranted.
So what's your response to footnote 5? Our analysis presupposes a contractually valid forum selection clause. Is this forum selection clause contractually valid?
It is, Your Honor, and I think that analysis collapses into the adequate alternative forum decision that the trial court made here that this court is reviewing for an abuse of discretion. So the question before this court is, based on the evidence before it, did the district court abuse its discretion in determining that the tribal court was an adequate alternative forum? And it did not. If we look at the evidence that was in front of the district court when it made that decision, there are really three things that it considered before granting the motion to dismiss. The first is the existence of the clause in the first place. This is a clause that it's undisputed that appellant drafted and in 2015 asked its employees to sign, and Ms. Myers did. And the appellant does not challenge that the clause applies if the tribal court is an adequate available forum. So that's piece of evidence number one. Piece of evidence number two are the two orders from that tribal court that Ms. Myers submitted with her motion to dismiss briefing. And the final piece of evidence is an affidavit from an individual affiliated with appellant in which he says baldly that there is no such court. And so when the district court looked at those three pieces of evidence, weighed them, and correctly assigned the burden to the appellant, the judge determined that the tribal court called for in the clause was an adequate alternative forum and enforced the forum selection clause.
When was the tribal court established and by what authority? That's not in the record, which is maybe part of the problem that I see here, but do you know the answer to those two questions?
That's right, Your Honor. It's not in the record, and I want to discuss the fourth piece of evidence that comes in after the motion to dismiss is
you answer my question first, and then you can tell me your additional information.
Yes, and I don't know. I don't know when this tribal court was established.
Okay.
I do know that if you look at iterations of the tribal court clearinghouse going back at least several years, that tribal court clearinghouse website we discussed in the brief, so that's maintained at the behest of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, does list this court as, or this tribe as having a court. So I want to address the constitutional issue because it's not one that this court needs to reach, nor should this court reach. We've cited authority in our briefs, primarily the Sack and Fox case out of the Eighth Circuit, that describes in very clear terms why federal courts should not exercise jurisdiction to involve themselves in intertribal leadership disputes, interpreting tribal law, or, as the Eighth Circuit points out, interpreting tribal constitutions. And so what the appellant effectively asked the trial court to do in a Rule 59 motion for reconsideration is to look at the constitution of the tribe from the 1930s and engage in original decision-making about what the meaning of that constitution is under tribal law. And there's no jurisprudential basis in the record for the district court to have done that, and there are good jurisdictional reasons why the district court did not do so. And more importantly, this court doesn't need to get there, because reflecting back on the issue on appeal is whether the trial court abused its discretion in granting the motion to dismiss based on forum nonconvenience. And really, what the district court is deciding is whether it is the appropriate forum for this dispute, and there's a well-founded basis in the record for the district court to conclude that it was not.
You referred to two orders from the tribal court submitted with Meyer's motion to dismiss. And what were those orders?
So those are.
Did I hear that right?
You said
that.
Your Honor, yes.
Okay. And so what do those orders, is that the tribal court we're talking about?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So it clearly exists now. Is that what those orders are showing, or what is the purpose of those orders?
That is exactly the purpose of those orders, to show that the court exists.
To show that it exists. And what did those orders say? I'm just curious. You say Ms. Meyer submitted them.
She did.
And what did they show?
So those orders happen to speak to the intertribal leadership dispute.
Okay.
They involve the tribal court.
Okay, I now know what they were. I just wasn't sure when you referred to them. Okay.
I want to return to the first issue, which relates to the alleged sovereign immunity waiver. So here, the district court correctly held that the appellant's trade secret claims were not disputes, quote, relating to GDUA's involvement in programs of the SBA. And that's because the essence of the complaint did not relate to the SBA program or its requirements.
Would there have been any dispute at all but for the SBA program?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor.
Did if the SBA program did not exist, would these parties have had any dispute between them?
Oh, I think they would, yes, because these are run-of-the-mill business tort trade secret claims in which a departing employee is alleged to have retained documents from her previous employer and then is alleged to have used those in competition. And so,
in competition for this program, right?
And, you know, the district court used the word incidental, and I think that's the right word, because it is not significant that those alleged trade secrets were being used to bid on a contract with the Navy that happened to be an 8A set-aside contract.
Why isn't that significant? It seems that was the issue, that she allegedly took the trade secrets because this other entity wanted to bid for the same project. I don't see how that's incidental, frankly.
Well, Your Honor, I would say it's because the parties are in competition for work in general. And the fact that they are bidding on a contract that happens to be an 8A contract is incidental to the trade secret claims.
So what would be close enough to relate to the program in your view? How much tighter would the connection have to be than a dispute about stealing trade secrets to use to bid for that program?
Sure. And I'm going to answer that, Your Honor, by referencing the three other district court cases that have looked at this issue, because I think they provide some good guideposts for how this court might conduct that analysis. So beginning with the Rossi case from the District of Maine, that case involved a plaintiff who was alleging retaliation under the False Claims Act and racial discrimination under Title VII. And the reason that the District of Maine concluded that those claims related to the 8A contractor's participation in the program is because those are legal requirements that are specifically applicable to 8A contractors. The False Claims Act, of course, applies to contractors who are submitting claims to the government, and there are particular code of federal regulations requirements for SBA contractors that require them not to engage in discrimination. And so there was that clear nexus between, to use this court's word, the below court's word, essence of the complaint and SBA contractor-focused requirements that the SBA has established. The same is true in the Hunter case a few years later from the District of Oregon. That was another employment discrimination case in which the employee was alleging employment discrimination, and the court relied on a slightly different CFR section in that same set that provided a requirement that was specific to an SBA contractor. Now, we contrast that, Your Honor, with the Applied Sciences case that comes out of the Eastern District of Virginia. And that's where the lower court here found that essence of analysis and the incidental word Because in that case, an SBA 8A contractor had purchased some contracts from another entity, and those contracts were, or some of them were, 8A contracts. And the allegation by the other entity was that the SBA contractor had done that, but then failed to fulfill the terms of the asset purchase agreement that caused it to acquire those 8A contracts. And on those facts, the Eastern District of Virginia said the connection to the 8A program is merely incidental. That is not within the scope of the tribal sovereign immunity waiver.
But do we have to answer that question if we decide that the forum selection clause is valid and we enforce that?
So, Your Honor,
we don't really need to decide the first issue, the sovereign immunity issue, do we?
I wish I could say yes, Judge. So,
okay, tell me why not, because I thought that was one way we could do this.
The district court only reached the forum selection clause after it had dismissed the claims against Gadua based on tribal sovereign immunity. So the district court's analysis was first dismiss the entity because...
Oh, because we have the other entity, so that's the problem here.
Right, so the district court never conducted the analysis as to whether the case could continue if the tribe was not immune, but Ms. Myers' claims had to be sent to tribal court pursuant to their forum selection clause.
Okay.
Now, I think there's a looming problem, which is going to be the reverse of the Rule 19 analysis that the district court concluded caused it to dismiss the trade secrets claims against Ms. Myers. So after the tribe was dismissed, the tribal entity, Ms. Myers was dismissed as to the trade secrets counts based on Rule 19 because the tribe is an indispensable party.
Right.
And I think the opposite problem arises if Ms. Myers is dismissed but the tribe is not immune, because this is an effort to get an injunction that is...
That she would be the indispensable party.
Correct. It would be the opposite.
Be the reverse.
That's right.
So, but you then still would not have to reach sovereign immunity.
Under that analysis, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
You would have to... I'm not saying we're going to do that. I'm just trying to understand the options here. So you could say she was an indispensable party, so it can't move forward.
That's correct.
Okay.
I want to talk a little bit more about the plain text of that sovereign immunity waiver and sort of what that language means in this context. So we should begin with the recognition that this is not a waiver that applies to all claims. That waiver is easy to write. It doesn't require a paragraph in an operating agreement or in the SBA.
What would it say? That was actually a question I was going to have for you. Let's say that the... Let's say that the desire was to write a waiver that would apply as broadly as your friends at the other table say this one does. What would you write?
Gidua waives its sovereign immunity.
Hmm?
Gidua waives its sovereign immunity.
But that would be for everything. I don't think the tribe would be inclined to do that, to participate in one. I mean, I can't speak for the tribe, obviously, but that would be a dramatically broader waiver.
Correct. That's exactly right. So the reason
you think the tribe would have to entirely waive its sovereign immunity over everything in order to waive its sovereign immunity over this claim?
I think this claim is not within the scope of the tribe's current sovereign immunity waiver.
I understand that you think that, but I'm saying that you think the only way for this claim to fall within any sovereign immunity waiver for the tribe is for it to waive sovereign immunity for all possible claims on any topic?
No, I think the tribe could waive sovereign immunity as to business tort claims connected to its efforts to submit a bid on an SBA contract.
I mean, how's connected to any broader than related to?
Well, it's actually the object of the related to that I'm focusing on, Your Honor, because we have not only language about related to participation in the 8A program, there are also examples. So the examples in the clause include 8A business development program participation, loans, contract performance, and when we're interpreting the primary phrase, what is related to Gidua's involvement in the SBA program, we also have to consider those non-exclusive examples that appear later in the clause.
How isn't the bidding? Why is the bidding process not related to participation in the program?
Well, to tweak that slightly, Your Honor, it's the allegation of trade secrets theft incidental to the business that causes the problem. I think if there was something infirm about Gidua's bid, and somehow that gave rise to a private right of action by a competitor, then perhaps that would be in the scope of the waiver. But that's not what they're alleging. They're not alleging that there's an SBA regulation that Gidowa violated in the context of the allegations that they're making. And that's why this is a different case from the Rossi case and the Hunter case and more like the Applied Sciences case.
Returning to the tribal court issue, if Ms. Myers is the one trying to enforce this contract, why isn't it her burden to show that the forum selection clause is valid in the first place?
Well, Your Honor, I think the Atlantic Marine quote answers that directly. There's also, if I may...
But as I said, Atlantic Marine presupposes a valid forum selection clause. For my part, I'm not sure how you get around that presupposition.
I think
there was no debate about the validity of the forum selection clause in that case, as I recall.
And, Your Honor, I think the first answer to that is that it's not disputed by appellant that the forum selection clause is valid.
I think you just disputed it.
I think today may be the first time.
Well, we'll take a look at that. But the question is, if a court does not exist, can a forum clause directing cases to that court be contractually valid?
Your Honor, in my mind, at least, that's the same question as whether the other forum is an adequate available alternative. And there are some examples from the case law of a forum selection clause that names a court in a particular town, and there is no court in that town. And then that's not an adequate available alternative. So I've not seen courts look at that as an issue of validity of the forum selection clause itself, but rather this same analysis about whether there's an adequate available alternative, which is the named forum.
Well, wouldn't the answer be that if you take Atlantic Marine, which directs us to shift the burden of proof as to the forum selection clause, if he's trying to violate it, why wouldn't it be his burden to show it's invalid? Okay. That it wouldn't matter under Atlantic Marine whether it's valid or not valid. He's trying to not abide by it. So no matter the ground on which he's trying to not abide by it, whether it's a contractually invalid provision or the court doesn't exist or whatever the reason is, why would the analysis change no matter what his argument is about the forum selection clause?
But, Your Honor, I think that's correct. I think that's what Atlantic Marine says.
Right. So even if you take the footnote in Judge Kahlon's order, let's say he's presuming it, he doesn't reach the issue. Let's say we reach the issue, so who has the burden of proof? If you're trying to invalidate something on its face, says you go to Connecticut or you go to the tribal court or wherever it is you're going, why would it not be the same?
That's our understanding of the Atlantic Marine case, Your Honor.
It seemed pretty broad. They want to tell the whole world how to do this. Oh, Justice Alito did.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court. I want to first go back to something Judge Hull referenced because my colleague was able to help me find where in the record I want to point you to, which is if you'll look at the supplemental exhibit, the sealed supplemental exhibit at 31-1 on the top of page 2, which is the signed agreement regarding dispute resolution policy that Ms. Tedrick and now Ms. Meyer signed, it says at the very top, if there is no tribal court in existence, then the CFR court, and then it goes on to say, and if that's not available, then a court of competent jurisdiction. She signed, contractually obligated herself, as part of her employment agreement in that document, to recognize that there may not be an adequate forum in the form of a tribal court. I think that goes back to the question you originally raised, Judge, and I wanted to direct your attention to that particular provision. Next, I want to...
It doesn't say anything if a CFR court doesn't exist.
It does. Actually, in the next sentence, it says, if there is an adequate federal court, then it can be that the jurisdiction can be in that jurisdiction. I point you to the end of that paragraph, Your Honor. If a federal law or contract with the federal government requires a different venue, the venue shall be determined by such other law or contract to the extent the same supersedes this policy.
Okay, I think my question was about whether it referred to the employee manual or the went outside that. So anyway, go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify the record to make sure the record was clear. That the thing that Ms. Myers signed regarding forum selection acknowledges the fact that there may not be a tribal court.
So let's say, I know we had a back and forth about whose burden it is, but let's say that it's your burden to show that this court does not exist. Do you think you reached that burden?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has the ability to see a constitution of a sister sovereign, and that is what the Alabama Cassarte tribe is. It is a sister sovereign to the federal government of the United States. And this court can look to the constitution of that sister sovereign and see that there is no provision. And curiously, I will admit, and it's in our footnote, the tribe is in the process of putting together a tribal court, but that it requires a vote of the entire tribe, and that has not taken place. Candidly, I would suggest to you that if this court were to remand this issue back to the district court, there may be a tribal court in place. And if that is the case at that time, then Ms. Myers' claims against her should be...
Are you saying there's not one right now?
There is not one right now,
Your Honor. That's your position?
That is absolutely...
And the evidence you have of that is...
Is I provided the district court with the Constitution, and despite the arguments of the counsel, two purported pieces of paper with no affidavit, no supporting documents, are not evidence. He refers to the two pieces of paper that are proposed orders. They're not evidence. There's no affidavit.
Are they proposed orders or actual orders?
They're figments of someone's imagination.
Are they signed by a judge or a tribal court official or whatever?
No, Your Honor, they're signed by an invalid, inappropriate person trying to create mischief within the tribe.
Okay, but it looks like an order if you didn't know the backstory.
Correct, Your Honor. If you don't know the backstory, and we provided the court with the backstory in the affidavit of Mr. Marshall, and importantly, when they tried to provide this information to show that there is an alternative court.
Okay, and I'm not trying to argue with them, I'm just trying to follow your argument. So okay. If they don't exist, then it says you go to the CFR, okay? And you're saying it doesn't have, if the CFR court doesn't exist. And are you telling me there's no CFR court either?
There's no adequate CFR court.
All right, and what evidence do you have in the record that there's no CFR court? You've already told me about the tribal court. Tell me about that evidence.
Your Honor, that evidence is not necessarily in the record because it wasn't.
There's no evidence in the record.
Did anyone assert that there is a CFR court?
No, Your Honor, no one asserted there's a CFR court. Okay. So it wasn't part of the record from below. But this court can take judicial notice of it because those issues regarding whether a CFR court exists are part of the public record.
My reading of the party's dispute has been they say that there is a tribal court, you say there's not. And so it's either the tribal court or the federal district court. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And let me ask you about the party's dispute. I didn't see. I just went back and looked at the summary of your argument. Whether there was no claim that the forum selection clause was an invalid contractual provision. You never made that claim, referring to the footnote in Judge Kahlon's order. There was never a claim in the district court, maybe it doesn't matter, or on appeal, that's not a valid contractual provision.
Your Honor.
I mean, you have contracts, so just a threshold issue, whether that's a valid provision. I didn't see a claim that doesn't matter what it says, that whether there's a tribal court or not, that type of provision is not a valid provision. Did you ever make that claim?
Your Honor,
on appeal.
I believe we stated that there is not a valid court on appeal.
I know you made that. That's a different question.
That was a question you just asked.
No, sir. I'm trying to say you have contracts, and you say this provision is an illegal provision or not a valid provision of the contract okay. Did you ever claim that was not a valid provision of the contract? Judge Kahlon, in his order, said this assumes a valid contractual provision. And so that's telegraphing to me. Nobody raised that issue. And then I just a few minutes ago looked at your brief to see if you said it was an invalid contractual provision.
Let me...
yes or no, or I don't know.
I'm not sure what the question is.
Okay, let me try it one more time. That's sure.
Quickly, there was a bunch of briefing that was taking place in May and June regarding both a motion for a protective, for a preliminary injunction, and a motion to dismiss. For the first time, this issue was raised in the reply to the motion regarding the preliminary injunction by the appellees, for the very first time, saying that there is not a that this should actually be in a different court. So we went through rounds of argument and rounds of briefing and all the initial stuff at the start of the case. They never.
And with all due respect, you're not answering my question on appeal, but that's okay. Your time is up and it doesn't really matter.
And I actually have one question. The scenario you gave earlier about a court, tribal court, being put in place as we speak. Let's say we do remand this case to the district court for whatever reason, and a tribal court is created during that interim time. What is your position on whether or not this case, which would be live, could be transferred at that later time once the court is created? Is it too late then, and therefore the federal court retains jurisdiction, or would you say that it would be proper for Ms. Myers or for the defendants to then seek transfer?
I believe it should be transferred to the tribal court, Your Honor, if it is created in the interim.
Thank you. We've got your arguments, and we'll move to our next case.